It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and let's listen in on a few of the week's big stories.
I want to say this again because there's been a little fun out there about us plowing under every single family neighborhood. 94% will see no upzones.
15 now did what they did. I got to respect the fact they got the signatures, and it makes sense for us to come up with something that we think makes more sense for Tacoma.
The taxation on firearm sales and ammunition is going to do nothing but drive me outside of the city to buy stuff.
Are you injured at all?
Yeah, I have a lot of burns on my hands, and I'm, like, kind of covered in bruises.
I'm not as prepared as I think I should be. I've got some water in the basement and some canned food put away, but, yeah, nowhere near enough. I'm also looking into earthquake insurance.
Well, we got some major foreshadowing this week of big stories that are going to be with us for quite a long time. We now know what the contours of the looming debate over affordable housing policies in Seattle will be. The stage is set for a big minimum wage fight in Tacoma. And we have a new timeline for Bertha to resume tunneling. And yet, these are just a few of the important news stories developing this week. We are going to get a look at some of the items overshadowed by the high-profile stuff with our panel of journalists. Rachel Lerman is technology reporter for the Seattle Times. Derek Young is founder and publisher of the Tacoma news blog Exit 133. And ending our one-week drought of Seattle-ish members, Hannah Brooks Olson writes for the Seattle News and Politics blog Seattle-ish. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're going to talk about our undercovered stories of the week, and let's just jump right into it with you, Rachel. What is your undercovered story?
So there was this really interesting committee meeting that happened Tuesday, I believe, about the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight. If you don't know what that is, I didn't. It is a civilian-run agency within King County whose job it is to investigate complaints made against the King County Sheriff's Office. There's been a lot of controversy in this department lately. The director stepped down and then sued the county for harassment. They settled for about $100,000, I believe. But most recently, the King County Auditor's Office released a report that essentially says that the sheriff has too much control over this office that is supposed to be investigating complaints made against the sheriff's department. It says that the sheriff can limit or completely take away access to documents, and that the sheriff is the one with the bargaining power about what oversight looks like, essentially creating, in the King County Auditor's Office words, a giant conflict of interest.
Oh, yeah. And this is interesting. This has flown under the radar this week, not only because of some bigger stories, but, I mean, the police reform conversation has really turned around Seattle Police Department, but the King County Sheriff's Department has got its own issues for sure.
It does, for sure. And we've heard about that quite a bit. You're right, though, less so overshadowed by the Seattle Police Department. And I don't want to attribute anything to the auditor's office. I shouldn't say giant conflict of interest. That's my words. They did say it was a conflict of interest, however. And the issue here is that the sheriff's office is denying that. They're saying that that's not happening. This is not a conflict of interest. This is really the best way to do it. And so now it's kind of up to the King County Council members about what they want to do about this. But I think as people, as members of King County, if you are a member of King County, we need to look at, do we want a civilian-run agency to be able to have complete control over complaints over the sheriff's office, or should the sheriff have a part in that?
And I wonder if any of the the way that this has been hashed out with the Justice Department for the city of Seattle, I wonder if any of that bubbles over into best practices for the Sheriff's Department, because the size and shape of the oversight is kind of at the heart of a lot of the police reform stuff for Seattle as well.
Well, sure. We have a really similar agency here in Seattle with the Seattle Police Department, which is the CPC. We have this civilian oversight committee that has just sort of come out of this grappling with the mayor and with Police Chief O'Toole about how much oversight and how much involvement this committee has. And the committee was scheduled to be disbanded, where it just wouldn't exist anymore. And so there's been a lot of tussling over how much control and how much sort of access these oversight committees have, because the idea with an oversight committee that's largely made up of civilians is that it gives people sort of more understanding and more accessibility to what's going on within the police department. And, you know, part of our DOJ decree is that the Seattle Police Department has to be more transparent. And so civilian oversight committees create that kind of transparency when they are permitted to do their job, which on the county level, it sounds like, is being made more difficult because of the additional oversight from the sheriff. And so I think the issue is, how do these civilian oversight committees exist, and where do they sort of live in the org chart?
Right, exactly. That's exactly the issue. And that's what the sheriff is saying. He's like, well, somebody has to be able to bargain with them. Somebody has to be able to, you know, decide what kind of access they have, you know, because, of course, there are, I'm sure there are classified documents that possibly for some reason a civilian committee shouldn't see, maybe. But is it proper to have the office that they are investigating also have control over what they can investigate?
Be the gatekeeper. Right, right. Well, thank you for bringing that story to our attention. And Derek Young, I'm pretty sure the only thing that happened in Tacoma this week was a walrus died. Is that right?
Yes. No, E.T. passed away. That's traumatic to our city.
Wait, is that the one who could predict the Super Bowl wins?
Yeah, that's the one that we're...
Oh, man.
E.T. has been in Tacoma since the early 80s, and he's a big part of everybody's, like, growing up in the city. Oh,
my heart light is glowing a little cooler. Well, obviously, okay, an important story. Don't mean to trivialize it, but definitely not an underreported story this week. However, there were plenty of things that did go underreported, including what's your story?
For me, the big one that was kind of emerging over the last several months has been the initiative to change our former government. It's been an issue for decades in Tacoma, but since the early 50s, the city of Tacoma has had a council manager form of government instead of a strong mayor. And there's been a movement ever since the David Brame scandal a decade ago to kind of move us towards a strong mayor. And
what's the difference exactly?
So the form that Tacoma has, the council hires a city manager, and the city manager then runs the day-to-day operations of the city. The mayor is basically effectively a figurehead that, you know, oversees the council but is there for policy but doesn't actually see day-to-day operations. In the strong mayor form, you elect the mayor who then becomes the person who oversees all the operations, hires and fires departments, all those kinds of things. And to some people, it increases accountability because it basically says the operations of the city then becomes something that the people are voting on and the people are doing that, where the city manager is a step or two removed from the voting public.
So you have this initiative that would make a big change to the way Tacoma is
It would make government. A tremendous change. And it was a big part of the conversation last year when we did our once-a-decade charter review process. It was a big part of the conversation, but that was not one of the things they chose to put to the voters.
So now it is before the voters. How are its chances?
Well, we had a little challenge this week. So this week, the organizers put their signatures in, and they have enough signatures for it to go to the voters. And then we discovered that the petition they used had a version of the charter that had struck out the entire section related to powers of the people and the ability for people to put initiatives through to change the charter. And this was unintended, but it's the officially submitted one.
So wait, if it were to pass... It takes a. I don't even know if I totally understand. If it were to pass, it would basically take away the right of the people to ever change the charter again.
Does it take away the right of doing exactly what they are currently doing?
That's what it reads.
Shut the door behind you.
I mean, the way it reads right now, that's how we're kind of interpreting that. And this last week, the organizers met with the city attorney and have been meeting with others to try to figure out how we fix this. And it looks like it would be an act of council. They would basically have to go through and kind of change what would go before the voters in the fall. What I'm hearing now is that what's going to end up happening, because this is the officially submitted, you know, version, is that it's going to go to the voters in this form with a really gnarly title that has to explain all the changes that exist within the charter. That would be difficult to get through. And I've already heard from two people that said they will challenge it in court the moment that it gets published like that. So whether it actually makes it to the ballot is going to be a challenge. Now, the bigger story, too, for Tacoma is this is a cursed initiative, because in 2003 and 2005, it got struck down due to technical errors and challenges with the petition to try to bring strong mayor before the people then. And so we've not been able to vote on this as a city since the early 70s. It may or may not happen again this year.
So it's effectively dead this year.
We are waiting for official word. And I talked to the organizers, and they're holding their chins up high, and they think that there's potential for a workaround. Well, I'm just not sure how that works.
Yeah, what could that look like?
It would take a tremendous will from the council, I believe, to actually make that happen.
It sort of reminds me of the whole ACA Supreme Court case, where the law contains the seeds of its own death in some ways. And the question is this a clerical error, or is this the intent of the drafters?
Right.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We'll be interested to keep up on that by looking at Exit 133, among others. And Hannah Brooks Olson, what's your choice for underreported story?
I am fascinated with what's going on at the Space Needle right now from a labor standpoint. There are employees at the Space Needle. About half of the employees at the Space Needle are represented by the Northwest Hospitality Union, Local 8, also called Unite Here. And those employees have been working without a union contract, some of them, since 2012, like for years. And there have been all these mediations. There have been 11 federal mediations in the last 11 years. There was a complaint filed against the Space Needle that was found to have a base where they were accused of actively trying to actively violating labor laws and discouraging unionizing, including telling their employees not to unionize and sending letters and sort of trying to keep them away from unionizing. And so this has been a really long challenge where there are people who have been working at the Space Needle who haven't gotten a raise in 3 years, 4 years, which in Seattle's economy is a lot. You know,
yeah,
if your
right.
rent is going up 10, 13% year over year, like you kind of have to keep up with the cost of living, and that's sort of the point of unionizing. So this sort of all came to a head this week. And it's interesting because a lot of people have been talking about this leading up to all of these mediations. There have been, I think, five mediations in the last 3 months, and just late night just conversations between the management of the Space Needle and the unions. And what was finally decided this week is there's still no contract. They still haven't really fully come to an agreement, but the Space Needle has agreed to give some wage increases, which they've been authorized to do all along, but they're just now going to do it. And so there are people who work at the Space Needle who are going to get, you know, raises of $1.50, I think $1.55, retroactive to 2011. So there are some people at the Needle who are really, who are getting some much-deserved payout. But there's still some really key provisions missing. Like, this isn't necessarily a huge win for the union because there still aren't job security measures in place. You know, the Space Needle continues to hire temporary summer employees who are hired at a higher wage than some of the people who have been there for years because they're not unionized. So the union was really trying to get some of those and better access to union reps. You know, there's a very small break room, I guess, at the Needle, and the Needle has said that they don't want that to be a place where union organizing happens and where union representation is. And so they have sort of, on the job site, they are also shuffling where people can talk to their union reps, which is a huge
problem.
Do
they have to take an elevator down 50 floors to go?
Yeah, right, kind of. And so what they're doing is they're limiting access to union reps. And so it's not 100% of a win for a union, but it is good to hear that some of the employees at what is arguably the most recognizable monument in the city of Seattle are going to be treated at least a little more fairly and are going to be able to get closer to being able to actually afford to live in the city.
And in terms of the precedent, I mean, it sounds like a lot of the conflict with the National Labor Relations Board and stuff like that was really over how much a company can do to discourage union affiliation among its employees. How many rules can you make about where and when they can do union activity? Are you allowed to give them a sample resignation letter from the union and say, just in case you wanted to fill this out, here you go? And this sounds like it hasn't really resolved some of those basic issues.
No, absolutely not. All this demonstrates is that the Space Needle is kind of tired of all the bad publicity they're getting. And so they were like, here's some more money. Please go away. And the union is not going to go away. But you're absolutely right that the Needle has done a lot to sort of like kind of carve away at the strength of the union. And this is a union. So Local 8, it doesn't just represent people at the Space Needle. It represents hospitality workers, right? So this has big implications in tourism because, you know, they also represent hotel workers and they've picketed hotels and they've picketed the Space Needle. We are seeing tourism in Seattle go up. We're seeing the tourism tax on hotel rooms go up, and it's finally not going to the kingdom anymore. Like, it's finally actually going to the arts and other things. And so being a city that is welcoming of tourists and also pro-labor and also makes it easy for people to live in the city is super important. So I think this story has really big implications.
And Hannah, it seems like right, from the Space Needle's point of view, I mean, they are a tourism-based company, and hospitality in general tends to be really fluid and unstable, and they need to sort of be keeping a lot of plates spinning in terms of getting the right workforce in the right place at the right time and all that kind of stuff. And from their point of view, a unionized workforce makes that a lot harder to manage.
Well, sure. I mean, for, you know, summer labor, there are obviously needs where there are more people visiting Seattle in the summertime, and so it makes sense to hire summer labor. You know, we talk about summer labor when we talk about labor laws all the time, because there was also this consideration with $15 an hour. Are we going to have a teen wage? Are we going to have, you know, an quote-unquote unskilled worker wage where you can pay teens a little bit less? And we decided that you cannot. And so those are still employees. And so summer labor is really important for tourism, to be sure. But when you look at the employees who work there all the time, the Space Needle is a tourism attraction year-round. And it helps to have people there who have a lot of Seattle history, who can tell tourists where else to go, who can be a really sort of insightful voice. And so it is very useful to have employees there who are there year-round, who are there for a long time. And so it makes sense to have some of those employees be unionized, because those are the people who are really the face of Seattle for people who visit. And so I don't think anyone is saying that having any kind of, you know, summer wage jobs or having any kind of, you know, temporary workers is a bad thing. And that certainly isn't the issue with the Space Needle's sort of issues with the union. But when you are hiring people temporarily for more money at the same time as you are telling union activists that you cannot pay them more money, and you know that the Space Needle makes a lot of money, it feels really disingenuous and it feels like a slight directly at unionized workers.
Hannah Brooks Olson from Seattle-ish, Rachel Lerman from the Seattle Times, and Derek Young from Exit 133. Thank you guys for bringing your underreported stories to Sound Effect. Come back again soon, eh?
Will do.
Will do.
Thanks.